for a number of years with World Vision as chief economist, climate change raconteur, etc., etc. He then spent a bit of time at the Australian Conservation Foundation. He's also been around Monash. And as you can see here, I think I said he has degrees in economics, science, theology, is that right? And other and development studies. Brett Paris, the group. There will be a
thank you all. I know this is a really hard shift after lunch on a Saturday. All of you have better things to be doing, I'm sure, than being in an MBA intensive class. So I'm grateful for you all turning up. This I just already gone through. You asked me to tell my... Where do I point this? Back here.
It might not be on. On the side.
Yep. Oh, the big on button.
That's the...
You asked me to tell a bit of my story first to give you some context here. Although I've worked in a number of different disciplines, which is helpful not just for, I suppose, the actual knowledge you gain in different areas. I'm sure many of you have got interdisciplinary backgrounds as well. But it's also really helpful in the process of discernment about different issues in other disciplines as well that you haven't actually trained in. So part of what I want to talk about today is not only information about sustainability and business, but also quite mindfully and consciously how we process that information and our cognitive biases, our psychological biases, and so on, to our filter, if you like, because we all see the world through a worldview, through particular coloured lenses, even if we're not aware of it. So part of, I think, essential training in sustainability in business is becoming conscious of our lenses and becoming conscious of our biases. So that's what I want to talk about a bit as well. That's all stuff that they don't really need to know that, having Jeff's introduced it. This is the whole roadmap of today, this Dilbert cartoon. I'll give you a second to read it. So the basic idea is that when we've got cognitive biases we're not aware of and inaccurate information because we've gained our information without awareness of our cognitive biases, that's when we drive our business strategies off a cliff. So it's absolutely essential that we're aware of these things. So this is where we're going today. I want to talk about some complex system stuff. This is concepts that you may or may not be aware of. With a very general audience like this, some of you guys will know more about this than I will, I'm sure. Some of you, it'll be brand new. So if it's new, great. If it's old hat, bear with me. These are essential ideas because if you haven't come across them and you're not aware of them, they don't even appear on your map. You don't even know to look for them. And economics... economics is particularly prone to forgetting about some of these things. I was very, very fortunate having trained in science and geology and chemistry before I ever got to economics, because some of the essential ideas and complex systems that you get from science that economists are just sort of blissfully unaware of. I make all these models that are bollocks, frankly, because they omit some of these essential things. Then logical fallacies and cognitive biases, they affect our ability to understand these different issues and our whole perception of them. I want to get a sustainability reality check. I know Jeff's gone through some of this, but I want to just, so having gone through those first two things, then just say, well, here are some like brute facts of the sustainability challenge that we've got that we have to kind of wrestle with in our businesses and our strategies. And then lastly, why spirituality matters, even if you're an atheist. All right, so complex systems, getting better information. Why do we care about complex systems? There's a great book written in 1996 called The Logic of Failure, and it's talking about different aspects of complex systems and how a failure to understand some of these core ideas will just inevitably drive your company, drive your processes into a ditch. So understanding complex systems, it doesn't guarantee that we're going to be successful, but not understanding them, or not understanding the kind of system we're dealing with, not understanding the kinds of questions that we need to ask of systems, or just making assumptions, because a linear system at the start looks like a non-linear system, which I'll get to in a minute, these are the things that can land us in all kinds of trouble, like this guy in the parachute. First idea is this idea of system boundaries. So when you're looking at a system or a problem or an idea, where are you drawing the boundaries around it? When you conceive of an issue, a problem in your business, a core process that you're trying to work through, where do you draw the boundaries? That has a huge impact on how you frame the whole problem and a lot of the questions associated with it. So even an idea as basic as net growth, I've had this sort of debates in the development area. You know, people would sort of focus on income generation and focus on rising incomes. That's all very well. But if you're not also taking account of people falling out the back end and suffering just total loss of their assets through illness or war or natural disaster or that kind of thing, if you're not focusing on both the where it's growing positively and where it's deteriorating negatively, both ends of the system, so you're talking about net growth, like a river flowing into a lake and then flowing out the other side, you're only looking at one part of the system. So if you're looking at the net growth or net, you know, level of a lake, you've got to look both at the inflow of water and at the outflow through stream and evaporation. So you've got to look at both aspects. Yeah, it's a very basic idea, I know, it's a very basic illustration, but it's easy to forget. The Mac is doing strange things to my diagram. Okay, this is another idea. When we're talking about economic development, the development is, you know, it's a big idea. It includes economic development, and economic development includes economic growth. But economic growth can have both pro-poor and anti-poor growth. So pro-poor growth is when you get very labour-intensive growth, lots of people getting jobs, general rise in the standard of living, this kind of thing. Anti-poor economic growth can be when you get typically big, you know, extractive industries, very capital-intensive, located in a remote part of the country. They don't employ much local labour. And most of the revenues, if any, go straight into central government treasury and then often back out into Swiss bank accounts through corruption and all this kind of thing. And the poor see not much benefit from that, and often they're left with a devastated environment. So you can have, you know, economic growth looking the same in terms of the national accounts, but, you know, one kind of growth is much more pro-poor and pro-development, and the other kind of growth can be neutral or it can actually be, you know, just devastating to the poor. So this is why I'm talking about, again, an example of system boundaries. If you're wanting to talk about development and you only focus on growth, that's hopeless for a start. But if you don't even distinguish between pro-poor and anti-poor growth, then your analysis is going to be just dreadful. Okay, second idea is non-linearity. There's a very, very big difference between linear systems and non-linear systems. So non-linearity can happen in, you know, all kinds of ways, but basically the idea is that responses are proportional to the forces and the effects, proportional to causes. So problems can be broken down piecewise into little bits. You can add up the problems and the, so if you've got A leading to X, B leading to Y, then A plus B, you know, leads to X plus Y. They're relatively simple, straightforward systems. You know, the whole essentially equivalent to the sum of the parts. These are, you know, broad brush strokes about linear systems. Non-linear systems are more complex. Relationships can't be simply taken apart and examined separately. There's no necessarily, you know, independent variable like we like to pretend there is in economics a lot of the time. Non-linear, again, is like saying most animals are non-elephants. You know, once you've got elephants and then non-elephants. Well, the non-elephants bucket is a big bucket with lots of different things in it. So there's lots of different kinds of non-linear systems as well. But basically, they're messy. A leading to X, B leading to Y. A plus B may lead to Z, something completely different. It's the combination. It's not just the individual elements that are important that add together simply like in a linear system. It's, you know, the elements adding together may produce a reaction that produces something quite different than what you're expecting. That's one kind of nonlinear system. Very, very simply, graphically, another key idea is nonlinear systems, not much seems to be happening at all. So this is just very simple data with just a periodic doubling of very small things. So not, for a long time, nothing seems to be happening. In fact, in the early stages of nonlinear systems, they can look exactly the same as linear systems. And so they can suck you in and deceive you. But then, suddenly, it all starts happening. I know Jeff gives this example of, you know, the doubling of the area covered by, you know, lilies on a lake. You know, when, if it doubles each period, when is you know, over 30 days it's going to cover the whole lake? When does it cover half the lake?
29 days,
yeah. So for a long, long time, looks like nothing much is happening. And then if you are leaving it until you start to see real change, then it can very often be too late, and talk about that as well. Another useful thing to keep in mind, very simple mathematical relationship, which you may or may not be aware of, is doubling times. There's a very simple thing called the rule of 70. And that is that the doubling time equals 70 divided by the growth rate, roughly. It's not precise, because it's, you know, complex than that, but roughly, broadly speaking. So if we're saying China's economy is growing at 7% growth per year, that means it's going to double in size in 10 years. Okay, just let that sink in for a moment. So now, you know, China's going to keep its economy growing very, very strongly to try to, you know, keep the lid on the pressure cooker, the social pressure cooker, and, you know, so on. But what that has, you know, huge implications for resource use, for energy use, for greenhouse gas emissions, for all this kind of thing. I know it's not growing probably 77% at the moment, but that's where they want to get it. So whenever you're thinking about or making projections, or your board are wanting you to make projections for certain growth rates, just keep in mind this rule of 70. Divide 70 by that growth rate, and that's what, you know, it's expected to double to in that period. Which brings us to lags and thresholds. As I said before, like linear systems, you know, you've got a fairly... The change tends to be relatively immediate and proportional to the cause, and it's relatively predictable. You know, you just keep that constant pressure up, and, you know, it's like you're driving a car up a hill at a constant speed. You know, as long as you keep your foot on the accelerator at a certain speed, it's going to go up the hill. It's predictable, and you know what you're doing. Non-linear systems have this phenomenon of thresholds. So that's when the system suddenly starts to kick in, the non-linearity really takes off. And it's these threshold effects. Those are what economists often ignore. The discipline has historically tended to ignore non-linearities because they're hard to model, basically. It's a discipline that became very, very heavily mathematized after the Second World War, and so focused on puzzles that were mathematically tractable and solvable. So it gravitated strongly towards linear models, linear equations, because nonlinear stuff is hard. Nonlinear differential equations are impossible to solve, some of them. So it focused on linear systems. But nonlinear systems, which characterize most of nature, have this phenomenon of thresholds, also called tipping points in the system. Now, you can have an eye, a sort of visual of tipping points when you've got these different basins of attraction in this diagramming where it's marked A. And you can see how in a simple system with one basin of attraction, the ball just sits there. It's not going to go anywhere. You know, you can sort of push that ball around a bit, right up and down, unless it flies off the edge. It's not going to go anywhere. It's always going to return to that system, to that lowest point on that curve, that top curve. And you can see there's four or five different ones underneath that, characterized by different kinds of equilibria. Now, economists, again, tend to assume that systems have, you know, one stable equilibrium point. That's the solution to the equations where the system will come to rest, or, you know, the equilibrium point. But natural systems and real-world economies can have more than one equilibrium point, or sometimes no equilibrium points at all. And so, you can, in that bottom diagram, you can see you push that ball up to the crest of the ridge, and it might teeter there for a while, or if it's got momentum, slide down the other side into another, what's called a basin of attraction, and it'll stay there, and it won't move from there. And that can happen to economies undergoing evolution, structural transformation. You might have one level of unemployment that sort of cycles around a particular set of figures, you know, sort of 8 or 9 or 10% or whatever, or maybe 2 or 3 or 4%, things are going well. But then the economy gets some big shocks, collapse of some of certain industries, this kind of thing, and it can shift the entire economy into a different basin of attraction where unemployment's 25-30%, and it can cycle around there for a long time. So we've got to be very careful of these tipping points in systems as well. Now, real world relevance for this. This is, don't worry too much about the text at the top, but this is a chart of publishing the journals, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. That's one of the top science journals in the world, looking at crop yields in response to temperature changes. And this is one of the things that is routinely ignored in economic models and assessments of climate change, because the economists doing them don't know anything about plant physiology. And just sort of assume that we'll get GDP growth, and then it will, maybe you introduce what's called a damage function, and so GDP growth might be 2% or 3% less than what it would have been otherwise. But by and large, things will continue as they are. Well, this tells a very, very different story. So you've got corn, what have you got? I can't see. Corn, soybeans, and cotton. And it basically says, beyond a certain temperature threshold, beyond which the plants don't survive or can't produce as much, productivity doesn't just decline nice and gently, it falls off a cliff. And you get major, major problems with not just crop productivity in particular localities, but you get political instability. There's when some of the big droughts that happened in the last 10 years or so, had major, major food riots in sort of 50 different cities around the world as a result of decline, sudden collapse of crop productivity. So when economists and particularly right-wing economists and market fundamentalists and some of the right-wing think tanks say, oh yeah, well, it's going to be much better just to adapt to climate change, they totally ignore this kind of thing. There are systems that we have that are fundamentally dependent on the natural world and its thresholds that cannot be adapted to. These systems just cross a threshold and collapse in terms of their productivity. Another key idea, and you'll see why this is relevant a little bit later. A lot of people who haven't done sort of high school science or forgotten it or whatever, have this idea that there are certain things called toxins, which are always bad under any circumstances, and then there are natural things which are always good under all any circumstances. But the basic idea of chemistry and toxicology is that the dose makes the poison. Most things can, for anything that's poisonous, anything that's good or natural for us, it's the dosage, the concentration that determines its effect on the system. And often these have threshold effects as well. So a certain thing can be tolerated up to a certain point, then it crosses a threshold, then it starts to wreak havoc with the system. So, water. Of course, it's fundamental to life. We need that. But if you drink 6 litres of water straight, you'll probably die. Just one after the other, bang, 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 bang. You can die from that. It has toxic effects at that level of drinking.
Do you want volunteers for that or not?
No. And alcohol, of course. Alcohol, of course, much less than that. Another key idea. Keep that lodged in your mind, that one about dose makes the poison, because it's relevant for the greenhouse issue later on. Network vulnerabilities, another key idea. Understanding the structures of the networks that we're dealing with and why there might be particular vulnerabilities in them. There's been a huge boom in studies of networks over the last 15 years, and there's been a lot of discoveries about the kinds of networks that are more robust and less robust. So this picture is from 2000. It's when there's a massive... 2003. There's massive blackouts right along the east coast of the US and Canada, and it was because of a relatively trivial network fault somewhere in the system, but it had this massive cascading effect right through the electricity networks and resulted in just blackouts right across the system. But if you look at that diagram on the right, you can see that network diagram, you can see where you've got these certain nodes coloured red, which are have many, many more other nodes kind of coming off them, so they play quite a central role. So you take some of those nodes out and you can, you know, basically take out the network. So understanding network vulnerabilities. Now this applies to computer networks, it applies to infrastructure networks, it applies to networks in your organisations, but it also applies to natural systems. And when you've got food webs and ecosystems, there are sometimes keystone species that when they get taken out, we think, oh, well, you know, who cares about this badger, whether it, you know, like goes extinct or not, you know, in the scheme of things, it's not that big a deal. Well, often it's, you know, if a keystone species is, you know, very highly networked and plays a particular role in an ecosystem, it can make a massive difference to not just that food web, but the entire landscape, in terms, because it's relationships with the vegetation and so on as well. Adaptive agents and resilience. Resilience is also a critical concept in terms of sustainability and business, of course. And it's always context-specific and system-specific. Nothing's totally, absolutely resilient with respect to everything. But the key idea is to focus on long-run, dynamic efficiencies, not just static, short-term efficiencies. One of the big, I think, challenges business has got at the moment, when, with a real sort of short-termism in terms of the you know, quarterly reporting requirements and boards and all this kind of thing, wanting results and shareholders wanting results, is a tendency to short-term thinking. But that has a huge danger in optimizing for the state of the system over a particularly short time horizon, which may look good for a little while until it doesn't in a really bad way. because you haven't got enough adaptability, you haven't got enough flexibility, you haven't got enough redundancy in your system. You've optimized it so lean and so tight for a particular state of the economy or a particular state of the market that you're not adaptive and you're not resilient. So that's a tough one, given the pressures that are on managers to optimize for the short term. System momentum. The momentum of systems can carry us even when we're trying to put it on the brakes to stop. This is a train crash in Paris in 1895, quite vividly illustrating the problem of momentum. Climate change has a huge problem with the momentum of the system. One of the things that most non-scientists don't understand is that what the effects that we're seeing now in terms of the changing of the climate are a result pretty much of what we put up into the atmosphere, you know, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years ago. We haven't yet seen the full effects of what we've emitted today. It's not an immediate responsive system like that. It's got lags in it. So that means even though we've had about, I don't know, 0.8 degrees of warming so far, we've already locked in another, I don't know, 0.6 or 0.7 or something, which is just guaranteed to come because of the momentum of the system. It's because so much of the heat has gone into the deep ocean currents, which take a long time to circulate and all this kind of thing. Complex reasons for it, but the system has momentum. The analogy I often give is, imagine you're driving a fully laden semi-trailer down a mountain road, okay, and you've got a passenger next to you, and you can see the curve coming up, and the passenger's saying to you, yeah, brake, you know, there's a curve coming, brake. And you're going, no, we don't need to brake. You know, we haven't felt the effects of the curve yet. When we feel the effects of the curve, then we'll turn. Okay? If you listen to that, if that's your view, you're stuck. You're going over the cliff. Because there's, you know, past a certain point, past a certain threshold in the system, there is no chance of stopping. You know, you have to brake well before you get right into the curve. You have to be slowing down well before you get in. If you wait till you're in, you can't stop. Just the laws of physics will push you off the cliff. Feedback effects, another key idea in complex systems theory. And that is, these systems are networked, they're connected, they have quite profound feedback effects throughout the system. Don't worry about the detail of this, but I'll give you just one example. The central white dot is says high latitude warming. It's connected to the loss of sea ice, so you get more, the more the Arctic Circle warms. People used to, when I worked for World Vision, I'd talk about the ice loss on the Arctic Circle, and people would say, oh, what do you care about polar bears? We, we do care about polar bears, but that's not the main reason we were worried about the Arctic Circle. The reason is because the Arctic ice cap acts as a giant mirror, reflecting, you know, more than 90% of the sun's energy that hits it. So as we lose the sea ice, the dark open ocean water absorbs much more heat, which melts much more ice. And as you get warmer waters around the Arctic, you've got about 1 trillion tons of carbon locked up in the tundra, the Arctic, the frozen soil, right around the Arctic Circle in Russia, northern Canada and Greenland. So you get this feedback, positive feedback. Positive doesn't mean good, it means it reinforces itself. So as you get more warming, lose more ice, that means more warming of the water, which means more carbon emitted from the tundra, which means more warming, which means more loss of ice. So this is the problem. Fat tails. Now, I'm not talking about Jeff. I'm talking about I'm talking about this idea. You're all familiar with the bell curve, right? Yeah, this idea that you've got bell curves, normal probability distribution, right? So the area under that curve, that blue curve, adds up to 1. So that's your, you know, 1 is your certainty of probability. 0.5 means 50% chance, okay? So the blue line is the normal bell curve. Well, you've just noticed that the tails are thin, okay? Fat tails is when it's not only the probability distribution shifting. So what's happening as the Earth is warming is that the probability of hot days, that whole blue bell curve is shifting to the right, if you like, if that's temperature scale. So it's sort of shifting upwards. So we're getting higher probability of warmer days. But what also seems to be happening is that the distribution itself is changing shape. Now, this comes from a paper on the financial crisis, but the idea is the same. What it means is that the tails are getting fatter, which means that extreme events are a lot more probable than they were previously, because it's no longer just a normal distribution. It's a fat tail distribution where you can have a much higher probability of really extreme events, like really extreme cyclones and this kind of thing. So this quote is just saying, the assumption again of economists was, traditional economists on the financial crisis, the models they were using is everything was sort of normal, bell curve, and so certain kinds of events just didn't happen. It was like having a 20-foot man walking through the door. Like, it's, the probability of that is zero. This is a photograph of Robert Waldo, I think, who's 8-foot something, the tallest man in modern times. But we have a certain expectation of what's possible and what's likely based on these sort of probability distribution curves. But these extreme events are becoming a lot more likely because the probability of them changing as well. Emergence. This is, again, a system property where things can emerge at higher levels that are not explainable or not simply the addition of things at lower levels in the system. So these are things like economics is a number of these ideas. So the invisible hand. The idea of the invisible hand is like an emergent property of the economic system. In Adam Smith's theory, anyway, it's this idea that everyone just acting rational self-interest will ultimately produce the best for society. This idea of an invisible hand being an emergent property of the system. Business confidence is another one, closely related to financial panic. These are like the mood of the market is an emergent property. It's not simply the addition of every individual's feelings about the market. It's almost like a thing of itself which can feed off itself and can be quite disconnected from the feelings of individuals if you just add them up. Also related to this, which I'll come back to later, is ideas about what is deemed sensible. Or what's scaremongering, what's radical. These ideas, which are very, very powerful, are also emergent properties of our political and media system. So someone gets, or a position gets labelled radical or dangerous in the media or crazy or whatever. Well, no one wants to be radical or crazy. So the sensible people who think of themselves as sensible want to step away from that. So these emergent ideas, properties, memes, if you like, are very powerful in terms of the way policy is developed around sustainability issues as well. that was that, complex systems. Anyone got any questions before we go on to...
The current China and what's happening over the last, 3 months, you'd say, with the economic slowdown, concerns, very erratic market reactions. That'd be an example of your threat to, say, of just that invisible sort of the unknown of what's going to happen to China and what are the implications.
And the potential for panic. And it will be interesting to see what happens with Volkswagen in Germany and the fallout from that. I mean, that group is the biggest employer in Germany, so I gather. And how the markets will react to that. It will take, in some senses, take on a life of its own, particularly if it combines with something else worrying going on, like China or something. So, you're right. My plan is to go through these cognitive fallacies, and then we'll have a break of 5-10 minutes, and then come back to the second part. Okay, just so you know where we're going. Okay, so these are five characteristics of science denial: fake experts, which lead to a magnified minority; logical fallacies, which produce things like red herrings, misrepresentation, jumping to conclusions, false dichotomies. Dichotomies is an either or. Impossible expectations. So, you give me absolute ironclad proof that I can understand. Yeah, so it's like me saying, look, I don't believe all this quantum physics nonsense. I want proof. The fact is, I couldn't understand the proof if it was given to me. I don't have the mathematical ability to understand the proof of quantum mechanics. Okay, so some of these impossible expectations just can't be met. Cherry picking, we'll talk about that. Conspiracy theories, notice the tin hat. I hope you've all brought yours. Logical fallacies, going through some of these. This is a really cool chart. If you want to have a look, yourlogicalfallacyis.com. I'm going to be using some of their slides in the next little while. But it's really good, because some of them you may never have heard of, some of you may be aware of, but it's really good. As managers, running businesses, interested in sustainability, I hope, understanding these logical fallacies and cognitive biases is critical, because it will help you not believe bullshit and will help you improve your strategy. So, all right. Anecdotes are not data. Okay, so, and the fallacy of anecdotal evidence is saying you use a personal experience or an isolated example instead of a sound argument or compelling evidence. Come across this all the time in the climate science debates, sustainability debates, vaccination debates, all this kind of thing. So you can see that I like this meme on the side. Face you make when someone uses a personal story to discredit broad expert conducted experiments and studies. It happens all the time. Although it is, there is a competing view on this as well. So anecdotal evidence, reliable, one man says yes. So this is, it's a bit hard to read. Say, press release, Mr. Mattingly's game at his detractors saying, this study shows what I've been telling people on the internet for years. All your fancy evidence and statistics don't mean nothing in the real world. He's a frequenter of internet forums, comment sections, social media. Mr. Mattingly recounts that he was inspired to undertake the study when someone reportedly kept insisting that he provide evidence of his claims. Well, I think everyone's entitled to an opinion, and my opinion's worth just as much as anyone else's. Academic types have criticised the study, and papers who are publishing it saying it lacks everything and makes no sense at all. So, go on and go on. It's just a bit of a laugh, but it's a bit tragic because it happens so often. You think I'm joking, right? Well, look, watch this. This is an article published in The Australian in 2010, February. It says, headline is Penny Wong signals doom for iconic beaches. Australia's most iconic beaches, including Bondi Bells and those of the Sunshine Coast, could erode away or recede by hundreds of metres over the coming century, according to Climate Change Minister Penny Wong. But locals aren't so sure. Bondi veteran Lee Bowman has swum in the beach for more than 30 years and was adamant he had seen no change to the coastline over that period. Nothing too drastic that indicates it's going to be changed in the future, said Mr. Borman, 53.
Yeah, I'm going with him.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Oops, I turned it off. What did I do? Yeah. All right, so anecdotal, and that's the face we make when we read a report like that in Australia. So this is what the CSIRO, meanwhile, actual scientists using satellite, you know, monitoring the sea levels are showing. Like, the sea levels are rising relentlessly. It jumps around a bit from year to year. Sometimes it, you know, decreases over 2 or 3 years, but it, the trend is absolutely unmistakable. But still we get this torrent of nonsense coming out of the...
You can say bullshit.
This torrent of bullshit coming out of the News Limited media, particularly. So the Herald Sun, you know, Courier Mail, Australian, blah, blah, blah. You can go on and on and on and on.
Is
that
3 centimetres and 10?
No, the scale's millimetres.
Yes, yeah. 33
centimetres.
Yeah.
No. Why is it negative? Negative?
So for 2004, we're at 0. 2004, I think, it's risen 30 millimetres.
Yeah.
That was the reference.
Yeah.
Yeah, it adds up. That's just the base year. It's not saying it was. No, it's not. The right left hand scale is the sea level relative to whatever the zero line is, which is just taken to whatever it is in 2003. Sorry, it's a little bit confusing. Yeah. All right, the next one is appeal to authority. Now, this one is tricky because. You have to use it with care. Appeal to authority is basically saying that just because an authority thinks something, therefore it must be true. Now, why I say we have to use it with care is because it depends how that authority has got to that point. So simply believing the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just because, you know, without, because it's an authority, it is a fallacy. But understanding the process of how they got to their views, a collection, you know, the collection of all the scientists all over the world, the process they went to, that process invests that institution with an authority that's valid. So you've got to be a little bit careful with this appeal to authority business, because sometimes climate denialists and so on say, oh, you're just appealing to authority. Well, no, it's more complicated than that. A tendency is also to disbelieve what we don't understand. So a fallacy of personal incredulity. Yep.
Can I put my hand up?
Yes.
How many of you understand the process the IPCC goes through to produce their reports? Okay, see, okay. So this right. is, you know, as Brett was saying, this is an appeal to authority. So basically, spread out how many chapter groups, aren't they?
There's three massive groups. Reports and...
They review all the published material, all the refereed reports, so all the science that's done is then put into refereed journals. So in other words, there's a reviewing process. That doesn't mean, again, appealing to authority doesn't necessarily mean it's all perfect, but, and I've said many times, don't worry too much about the individual events, but look at the trends. So if something's, there might be 1,000 papers published over that period on sea level rise. And so then there are committee structures of eminent scientists in the areas who then review the reviewed articles and try to bring together a consensus view, which means there's lots of debate and argument. And then there's a sort of writing subcommittees, I suppose you'd say, who take those consensus views in each of the areas and write up preliminary chapters, which are then sent off around the world to
Tens of thousands of comments and
hundreds of reviewers who then review those chapters. So it's a review on a review on a review, and then eventually there's a consensus document, which means there's always lots of disagreement around the edges. So whether it was 0.86 that sea level rise was going to be, or 0.91, or point this or point that, but the trends are pretty clear. So that appeal to the IPCC, because Brett will have heard this as I have, you know, what a load of bullshit, they're just politicians, they're just this, you know, UN cronies, you know, they're just writing in the back room, etc. Not true. You know, thousands of scientists the world over in their areas have debated and argued at level after level after level. Then preliminary documents are written, then sent out for review, then they come back to write that fine. I don't know how they ever get it done, actually.
It's no fun. And also the critical last phase as well is where the summary for policymakers is done. That's like a distillation of the scientific work. And the summary for policymakers is gone through line by line by governments and then signed off by governments. So the summary for policymakers has been through the most rigorous scientific process and then signed off by the governments of, including major fossil fuel producers, Saudi Arabia, Russia, US, China, Australia. You know, so it's signed off by, you know, if there was any possible way they could not sign off on it because the science was weak, they would have found it. So it's almost like a lowest common denominator of what the science is saying.
And that's often the argument that folk in the climate science area will argue is that what comes out has been weakened. And it is the lowest common denominator. So if the IPCC is saying that, you know, it's going to be a 0.6 sea level rise to 2100, then you can almost bet your bottom dollar that that's the weakest or the strongest figure they could get in there, but much less than what most of them probably thought.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Jeff. So the next one, anyone heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect? I will have to look into that.
You start looking better as you get older.
Send me a link. Right, I need that. The Dunning-Kruger effect is from a very famous paper in 1999 in psychology. Basically, the paper, the title, I love it. It's called Unskilled and Unaware of It. It's basically this idea that often that there's this curve between the amount of confidence people have in their views and their expertise and their actual competence. So it's often it's the stupidest, most unaware people who are extremely confident about stuff, and you know the most intelligent or most aware people have the most doubts because they know how complex things are. They know if they've studied deeply in one discipline, they think, okay, well, I shouldn't just assume that you know biochemistry is just simple and I can just you know make it up on a you know draw it up on a couple of bits of paper. It, you know, if my discipline is complex, then probably others are as well. You know, and so, but people with no expertise in anything, they just assume everything's simple, and the, you know, they get a Google degree after you know a couple of hours on Google and think that that makes them experts. And so, this is a real thing, and it's a real problem. It's a real problem for the sustainability discipline, and for you as managers dealing with your organisations and your boards, because you'll have plenty of people who think they're competent, they're far more competent than they actually are. It's also a good bias for us to be aware of ourselves. And probably, I'm sure there's areas we all have where we're not as competent as we think we might be. So it's always good to you know, read the other side's stuff, in a sense. You know, read the critiques of your own positions. Read, you know, don't be threatened. Don't if you find that you've got a... If you look in yourself and you're mindful and you find that you're actually quite defensive and clinging to a particular position, you're somehow like really invested in it for some reason that is not particularly related to the knowledge or the science or whatever, then that's probably a good thing to be aware of, because there might be other things going on that's making you cling to a particular view that may have nothing to do with reality, that might have a little bit to do with this. So, no, your opinion is probably not as valid as that of an expert. This is, again, a challenge. We have this democratized society, which is great. We have access to the internet, which is fantastic. We have access to more knowledge than we've ever had at any time in history, which is wonderful. All these things are fabulous. But there are also, you know, disciplines are complex. You know, we don't think that... you know, people say, oh, scientists are arrogant. You know, that view's arrogant. Well, you know, just let people believe what they ever want to believe. Well, no. Like the thing on the right, which I've carefully scrubbed out that rude word so you didn't see it. No, not all beliefs are worthy of respect, and we have to, I think, be willing to say that. Some beliefs are just bullshit, or dangerous, or racist, or whatever. Plumbers, anyone here a plumber? Okay, plumbers know more about plumbing than we all do, right? Probably. Same as mechanics on cars, like there is expertise involved. You know, computer systems engineers know more about network engineering than I do. And I'd be stupid to pretend otherwise. And it's exactly the same with some of the climate science. You know, just because they come up with solutions or things that we don't like, doesn't mean to be saying, oh, well, my opinion is just as valid, and you know, go off down that tangent. Because, and that's precisely the kind of view, not listening to advisors, not listening to experts in their field, is the kind of thing that as a manager will, you know, can send your business off a cliff. This is an example of that. There's an ad, there's a wonderful TV ad a few years ago now. It was come out from the Competitive Enterprise Institute in the US. They had this girl, you know, sort of skipping through a meadow in a dress and, you know, blowing, you know, petals off the flowers, and the voiceover said, carbon dioxide, they call it pollution, we call it life. You know, like this. But it's
gorgeous.
Oh, yeah. But it's this idea, you know, CO2 is natural, how can it be a pollutant? Yeah. You know, it's like it's appealing to ignorance. Well, let's see what it's appealing to. It's appealing to personal incredulity. I don't understand it, so, you know, why should I believe it? The dose makes the poison, remember? Okay? It's not whether something small that matters. Something can be small and still have a profound effect on the system. Yeah, you know, a computer virus. A single drop or fraction of a drop with a nerve agent VX, less than 10 milligrams, will kill you stone dead. Okay? It doesn't have to be big to have a catastrophic effect on the system. Okay? And this is what this stupid ad, which, you know, they were either stupid themselves producing it, which I doubt, because they're actually quite smart people, but I think they were playing on the lack of education of their intended audience.
What are they?
Compared to right-wing market fundamentalist think tank in the US.
Funded by the Koch brothers.
Yep.
Was it actually brought out for a specific purpose? Like, was there some legislation they were up against?
Just all the time, this kind of thing. Yeah, it may have come out at a particular time, but I'm not exactly sure when.
My understanding is it's very much fueled by the tobacco logic, that confusion and doubt is our greatest
ally.
And so we just sow doubt. So you say CO2 is bad, but how can you say CO2 is bad?
Yeah, it's essential for life.
Life.
That's true.
And it's true. Without CO2, we don't live.
Can you just clarify for me? CO2, in brackets, the most important of 60 greenhouse gases.
Yeah, it's cut off a bit.
Because I just didn't know that well, because I thought methane was unequal. I don't know the difference between destructive nature.
Basically, you've got like CO2, if you like, which, you know, has this effect total. And then you have like a bunch of other gases which have sort of that effect total. Now, individually, some of them are much, much more potent than CO2, but they're in smaller quantities. And right. So methane falls into that category. Yeah, it's much more potent. But there's not as much. There's not as much of it. So
some of the air conditioning refrigerants
have
like 10,000
of times more.
I understand that part, but in terms of what it's most commonly the gas that gets brought up is directly behind CO2 in terms of volume, I suppose.
Volume and... I don't know off the top of my head whether CO2 or some of the nitrous oxides... Sorry, methane or some of the nitrous oxides are, in terms of volume, I'm not sure. But yes, you're right. Methane is, you know, a very close second as being one of the most critical.
I was just trying to get an order, pecking order, if you like.
But I think the effect, the equivalent CO2 with methane is about 21. So methane is equivalent to 21.
Yeah, roughly. CO2 methane also, I think its effect declines much more rapidly than CO2. So the CO2 effect lasts much, much longer. So even though it's not as potent at a particular instant of time, because it lasts much longer in the atmosphere, its long-term impact is more effective.
It sort of supports this whole, you know, you've got to be you've really got to try to understand the science or accept that something's going on beyond your just looking out there and saying, this can't be real because it's a lovely day type stuff. And each one has its concentration, its half-life and all that sort of stuff, which overall gives us a CO2 equivalent.
And on that, you know, that root series that was on SBS about uranium recently, the guy was walking around with a, can't remember the fancy name of the meter, but it was measuring radiation everywhere he went.
The guy who
came?
Yeah. No, it wasn't that. Just solar radiation. And he was actually putting it into quite simple terms of exactly what these last couple of slides have
been. Yeah.
It's fascinating.
All right. Next logical fallacy is middle ground, and this is the media falls for this all the time. So it's this idea that, well, if you've got one side saying this and another side saying this, then the truth is probably in the middle. Okay, don't fall for that as managers, as directors or whatever your roles are. Don't fall for that. It's bullshit. It's a logical fallacy. You know, try and find the truth of the different positions. You know, it's just a lazy kind of media thing. You know, they. Yeah, you know, John Oliver, I don't know, some of you may have seen the clip, I should have brought it, but he has this wonderful clip of, you know, the typical media thing is you get a science expert and then you get, you know, one of the deniers as well to give, you know, the other side, you know, the disillusion of balance. He does this wonderful clip of actually making it proportional. So he has, you know, one climate denier in an interview, and then he brings in like 98 or 99 other actual scientists to, you know, to combat this guy, because that's the real state of the debate. Well, actually, it wouldn't even be a whole person as him. But
I think he has three.
Two or three, is it? Yeah.
Two or three deniers, and he brings in 97.
Yeah, but this idea of middle of the truth being somewhere in the middle is a really dangerous fallacy, and it's very easy to slip into because it sounds quite reasonable, and it's, you know, it's a useful heuristic, if you like, a useful rule of thumb for issues that we perhaps don't really care about, that aren't that important. It's reasonable to say, oh, if you've got two extremists, you know, the truth's probably somewhere in the middle. But on climate science, on sustainability issues, it's a hopeless heuristic. This idea, another anchoring is a more of a cognitive bias than a logical fallacy, but it's this idea of that the initial numbers that are put out have an effect of anchoring discussions. So, and it makes other, the introduction of new information more difficult because the discussion is sort of oriented around a particular set of numbers. And it determines very strongly what's considered extreme. So in the early, 10 years ago, the debates around climate, or the political debates around climate science and what emissions reduction targets should be, were the initial thing, fairly modest. You know, they talked about 550 parts per million mitigation pathways and this kind of thing. Well, now we know that's just hopeless. It's going to send us well and truly over 2 degrees and so on. But those sort of anchoring effects have an effect in that they make more robust proposals seem extreme. So you can often very strongly influence the debate by being the first one to put numbers out there, because then the debate sort of orients, uses those numbers as a kind of anchor and a reference point. That's very important to be aware of this. Genetic fallacy is dismissing an argument just because of where it comes from. Again, easy to fall into. Genetic, not in the sense of genetics, so that DNA symbol is not that helpful, but it means genetic in the sense of genesis, you know, where things come from. Okay? So it's that, you know, where does information come from? It's very easy. And again, it's a useful heuristic. You know, I don't read much that comes from the Institute of Public Affairs or the Australian newspaper. So, you know, organisations or individuals that have built up a track record for bullshit, you know, it's reasonable to dismiss it. But sometimes they might have something that's useful to hear. So that's important as well. So don't simply dismiss something because of where it comes from. But that's often what... But that we've seen this fallacy play out very, very strongly in our political scene over the last 5 years, because the right wing of the Liberal Party and National Party have basically viewed climate science through the lens of their culture wars and through the lens of viewing it everything's political. This is basically a left-wing conspiracy. And so they've viewed, because information is coming from, you know, a lot of people of a more progressive bent or more leftist bent or social, because a lot of those groups think a certain thing, they've basically dismissed it, saying, oh, it's all bullshit because it's coming from the left. And I think, I mean, that's driven the right of the Liberal Party basically into irrelevance on this issue. Well, I wish it was irrelevance, but it's had catastrophic effects on our policy environment and on the uncertainty around climate policy, renewable energy targets, or all kinds of things. But this fallacy is actually very, very powerful, and it has real world effects. So it's basically, you know, failure to engage seriously with the substance of the argument and just dismissing it because of where it comes from. That's what this is. Confirmation bias is related to that. It's basically just looking for stuff that reinforces our existing views. So again, beware of this. And again, it gets back to, you know, if you're too invested in an idea and you just observe yourself where you look for information. If you find yourself only looking for stuff that agrees with you, notice that. And be aware of that. And if you find yourself only wanting to listen to advisors who will reinforce your views, that's something to be careful of, because you're very easy to fall into this confirmation bias trap.
And you mentioned this earlier. The dilemma is we're often not consciously aware of these. In fact, rarely are we consciously aware of these things.
Yep.
And this was highlighted today earlier when I asked you, you know, things like ecological economics and some of the stuff that I've been talking about, has this been raised anywhere else? And the answer is no. Well, not in in your programs, for example, right? And, I mean, if you think about it, that just confirms the view. And in some of the other material we might get to, I've got some stuff from McKinsey, in some of your readings and that, you can go online and see it. And of course, it supports the view that we only really do it if it makes money, and that is supported by the view that where does McKinsey get its people from? The top business schools, who self-reinforce, a positive reinforcing loop, that same view. So the confirmation bias is all around us. And who do they talk to? The boards who have the same view. And so, you know, we're all happy together and we don't have to listen to any of this rubbish.
Mm. Exactly. And this, and I'll come back to this a little bit later, but again, I want to drop in before we get there. This is, again, why I want to say spirituality is so important. Okay? I don't mean religion necessarily. I mean your spirituality in the sense of if you're finding your identity and meaning and reason for being in a particular worldview or plan or structure or business plan or goals or whatever it is, and you're not self-aware of that, you're not mindful of that, you're unaware of your own biases, you're unaware of your own cognitive biases, you're unaware of how much of your personal identity is invested in a particular view, it makes you very vulnerable to these kinds of things. So again, it's the spirituality, you may not believe it, but it matters for this kind of stuff. It matters for your development of your strategy, for your self-awareness, for where you get your advice from, your whole worldview, everything. We're getting to the end of this and then we'll have a break. Okay, cherry picking, classic. This idea that basically you take the data, you cherry pick it, you find, you know, happens all the time on temperature data, you know, they'll pick a certain period that shows temperatures flatlining or going down or whatever, but it's basically when people are cherry-picking data, choosing what they want to reinforce their preconceived ideas. It's pretty straightforward. Cognitive dissonance. This is a really, really important one. This is from Frantz Fanon, who was, you know, a fabulous educator. He says, basically, sometimes people hold a core belief that's very strong. When they're presented with evidence that works against that belief, the new evidence cannot be accepted. It will create a feeling that's extremely uncomfortable called cognitive dissonance. And because it's so important to protect the core belief, they'll rationalise, ignore and even deny anything that doesn't fit with that core belief. Upton Sinclair said, it's difficult to get a man or woman to understand something when his salary depends upon him not understanding it.
Thomas Kuhn talked about it as paradigm blindness.
Yeah.
That you just couldn't see the new information if it doesn't agree with your existing.
Yeah. This gets, I guess, particularly to the core psychology, the core spiritual identity of something, and again, why it's so important to be self-aware of these things. And it's a good, I mean, I want you to have a think about this during the break or when you, sometime. You guys are kind of got a unique opportunity in taking a bit of time out from your normal, very, very, very busy lives to do some reflection, some learning, some education. Have a think about this question. What are you unable to let yourself understand? What are you unable to let yourself understand because the implications might be too significant? What's the issue? What's the information? What's the new worldview that you know is in your peripheral vision, but you can't let it in? You can't see it. You can't really see it and own it because the implications might be too big. What are you unable to let yourself understand? Okay. Let's have a break. I'd like, during the break, if you want to have a chat, get some coffee, what, break for 10 minutes? Have a think about, what I'd like to do is have a think about some of those logical fallacies, cognitive biases, and just think about your work, your jobs, your worldviews, whatever. Is there anything that's maybe struck you from your work, or any examples that maybe you've seen of some of these things in action, or that you've become aware of in your own views? And then it'd be great to have a couple of people's responses when we come back.